for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Blackberries, cell phones, and laptops speed communications, but they've also become the electronic equivalent of an unlocked door on a busy street. Security experts claim that would-be intruders have increasingly sophisticated ways to steal, or perhaps even better, take control of computer systems. And many say the risks we face in the government and corporate world are largely unacknowledged. Joining me to talk about cybersecurity threats and what we can do about them, three cybersecurity consultants, Paul Kurtz, Alan Paller, and Stephen Spoonamore. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Paul Kurtz, if I could start with you. You've said there is something of an awakening going on with respect to the kind of public and private awareness of this problem that's going on. Say a little more about that.
If you will, it's a global awakening where you have, in the past year, we've had several events in Estonia. There were a massive denial of service attacks, which took government systems offline and banks offline. If you roll forward to mid-year last year in Germany, Chancellor Merkel made a point of pointing out the cyber risks, noting that China was a problem. If you forward into late last year, the UK, the MI5, the internal intelligence apparatus within the UK, noted to the top 300 companies inside the UK that there are grave cyber risks, that companies and government need to do better. And then if you roll forward into the beginning of this year, President Bush signed a national security directive, if you will, his highest directive, noting that the government needs to do more and establishing several programs in order to do better on cybersecurity. At least what the president did was focus on government. It really hasn't focused on the private sector, which obviously is an issue we'll discuss today.
Alan Paller, talk about the kinds of risks that both government and the private sector face.
The biggest one right now is the combination of theft of information and control of information. So the attackers get in and they steal a lot of data. For example, that letter from MI5 that Paul talked about said to those companies that if you're doing business with China, all of your computers have been penetrated, as have your lawyers' computers and your accountants' computers. And so all the data about the deal and everything else in your computers has been taken. So that's one. But what the second risk is that they leave software on the computer so that if they want to later, they can come back in and read the email that's been posted later. So it's a combination of taking today's knowledge and controlling the flow of knowledge for the future, and it's very sophisticated tools that they're using now.
And Stephen Spoonamaker, I hear a lot of people sort of pointing the finger at China. Is China our biggest worry as far as cybersecurity is concerned?
Well, I view China as the most active player on the international front, especially when it comes to industrial espionage. They spend an enormous amount of time with very sophisticated tools. Most of China has been converted over into a higher standard of internet called Internet Protocol Version 6. It's 4 times more powerful in the code it can carry than what most people in the U.S. use, which is Internet Protocol Version 4. We, as a consequence, are fighting against people with a much superior software penetration tool and speed of access, and they spend an enormous amount of time mapping many of my commercial clients' assets, assumably because they'd like to know exactly how they do their business.
Paul.
China is certainly the focus of attention right now. Russia is also a focus of attention and organized crime. But one of the real issues we have in cybersecurity is attribution, really telling who's actually behind these attacks. In many of the cases that we could talk about, the attacks may appear to be coming from China. The code may appear to be developed in China, but can we really prove that? That's an issue that the U.S. government has to address, the private sector has to address, and the IT industry has to address. How do we really develop the capabilities to understand where these attacks are coming from? I'm not saying they're not coming from China. I'm not saying China's not a problem, but attribution is a real hurdle for us.
But before you even get to attribution, don't you have to know exactly what's happening in the private sector as well as what's happening in the public sector? In that, aren't there many private organizations, businesses, who are not reporting this kind of incident, Alan?
It's so embarrassing to report it. It's like having your children have hair lice. You're
really?
Just not going to admit
really?
It. The cost of reporting is 10 times the cost of not reporting, no matter what happens to you.
To whom would you report?
Well, there's a law in 31 states now, a lot of states, that says if you've lost any data about your customers, any personal data, you have to tell the state about it and tell them about it.
Who within each state is responsible for receiving that kind of report?
It's not the state that gets the report. It's actually the public that gets the report. So you have to admit that you've been penetrated. You have to tell all your customers. You have to send them each a letter. It's embarrassing at a level that people just say, whatever happens if I don't tell is better than telling.
And loss of business, I would imagine, as well, Stephen.
I would say that the commercial sector is becoming a little more sophisticated about it over the last year to 2 years, in that it's like being an alcoholic. I have to admit I'm an alcoholic before I can do something about it. Most of the industry is now admitting the scale and scope of the problem, and certainly internally taking efforts. The public reporting component, which Alan very rightfully speaks to, is complex and embarrassing. But more importantly, we're seeing a lot of effort made on the commercial front to simplify and mitigate the situation.
You know, you've all talked about various countries that might be involved at the same time. What about the idea of individual hackers at work? Someone said on this program recently that the Pentagon is and their computer system is hacked into thousands of times a day.
A minute.
Well, there are several levels of reporting. There's a reporting that needs to happen as far as the impact of breaches on one's sensitive personal information, your bank account numbers, your social security numbers, all of that type of information. But then there's the breaches that occur against a defense industrial base, the national security information. What is the reporting mechanism for that today? In both cases, there really are not concrete reporting mechanisms. What Alan has pointed out, what the states have done, the states have taken into their own hands, because the Congress has not passed a law that puts in place a common reporting standard in the case of a breach of sensitive personal information.
Why not?
It's hung up within several committees on the Hill. Multiple committees have jurisdiction here. Finance Committee, Commerce Committee, Homeland Committee, Defense Committee. Multiple committees have jurisdiction. So getting such a bill through the Congress and ultimately to the president's desk has been exceptionally difficult.
Alan.
I just want to take it back to the listener's level, which is, does this affect me or does this just affect the businesses? It turns out that most of the cybercrime is not against government, and it's not espionage. Most of the cybercrime is taking over personal computers, putting keystroke loggers on it, which read all your keystrokes, taking your bank credentials and emptying your bank account. And right now, homeowners don't have to worry about this at all, because just like credit card losses, the banks tend to cover you. But it's happening at the tens of billions of dollars level. It's comparable to the drug trade. And it's not other governments. It's organized crime. The head of this area for the Secret Service once said, any organized crime group that's not doing this should be sued for malpractice, because it's such a good crime. You don't get killed. And you take a lot of money, and the banks are paying an enormous amount of money, as are commercial organizations, as are the merchants
You know, you guys, you're scaring us all. The question becomes, how fearful should we be as individuals?
You shouldn't be fearful at all about using your computer to do online commerce. You're covered. The banks cover you. They're building better protections in. It's the same as credit cards. You still use your credit card, even though some people steal credit cards.
Stephen, you're shaking your head.
I don't do online banking.
You do not?
No, I build back-end systems for banks. No, I don't.
Does that mean you don't keep a record?
Well, you have the choice of doing, banks like it because it doesn't cost them anything. Once they've built the back end, it's an automated process. But most of the back end systems, the credit card companies actually have a much higher standard in most of their back end systems than the banks do, because the banks, they're not the highest caliber back end systems.
Paul.
I would agree with Alan that people should still certainly use their computers to engage in e-commerce. They should engage in online banking. I do, and I spend all my time on cybersecurity. What I think the real issue here today is that is capturing people's imagination is where this was once, if you will, cybercrime, if you will, going after personal identity. Now it's going after intellectual property. It's the plans, the programs, the designs of American industry. And that's going to have a tremendous drag on American industry over the long haul. It's also going to have a drag on our national security over the long haul. That's, I think, what's really capturing people's imaginations today.
Paul Kurtz, he's former White House cybersecurity advisor. Stephen Spoonamore, a cybersecurity consultant with government and commercial clients, and Alan Paller, research director of the SANS Institute, which I want to know more about when we come back. Short break. That's the number to call if you'd like to join us. 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. We have three cybersecurity consultants with us, one of whom is Alan Paller of the SANS Institute. Tell us about the SANS Institute.
SANS is great fun. It's the principal research and training organization in security. So about 14,000 people a year come and bury themselves hands-on on learning forensics and learning intrusion detection and learning all the penetration testing, all the techie things. We train the NSA people and the FBI people and just all of the different organizations that do cybersecurity. But we also run the early warning system for the Internet, called Internet Storm Center, which is online. It's like a weather service available to everybody.
And Paul Kurtz, tell us about your work as a former White House cybersecurity advisor.
I work with a variety of private sector clients. We work closely with those who have special or unique security problems. It could be a very large e-commerce organization, could be a bank. It could be an organization that is actually selling security. But one of the issues I spend a lot of my time on now is software assurance. There's an organization that has just been stood up called SafeCode, which is dedicated to building software that is more secure with better integrity. Several private sector firms, Microsoft, Symantec, EMC, Juniper, others, have come together to see what they can do collectively in order to improve the security of software. That's a mammoth task, which is of real interest to the U.S. government here as well as government overseas.
And Stephen Spoonamore, you're also doing cybersecurity consultant work with both government and commercial.
I principally work on the commercial side. I do work for the global credit card industries. Within our industry, there's a standard by which all credit cards in the world are manufactured, and then that data is injected into the banks to activate an account. That's about 9 billion active accounts, and I write, maintain, and create monitoring systems to make sure that when an account is created, it's real and attached to your identity.
All right. In a National Journal piece, reporter Shane Harris talked about the cyber community suspicion that hackers were actually behind the massive blackouts that occurred in New York in 2003 and one in Florida earlier this year. Paul, what is your thinking?
Well, at least in the case of the blackout in 2003, at that time I was at the White House Special Assistant to the President on Critical Infrastructure, and one of the first things I thought of was this a cyber attack? And if it was a cyber attack, from where? But the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Energy undertook an investigation, and one of the things we really focused on was the digital records. And there's nothing there that says that China was behind this. There's nothing to say that there was code inserted into any one of the systems. It's a matter of public record that is, if you will, Murphy's Law. This was poor maintenance among the electrical power providers, removing tree limbs and all those kind of things. That is not to say, though, that our critical infrastructure, the power grid, oil and gas networks, banking and financial networks, are not being mapped today by, in fact, China. But I think 2003, it's incorrect to attribute the 2003 blackout to China.
You agree with that,
Stephen? I completely agree. We come at it from different angles, but certainly since 2005, I work with all of the Class 1 railways and all of the credit card companies, and we have seen extensive mapping of our switching, our interface systems, loading docks, fueling facilities. All of the IT associated with those are actively being mapped by at least assets that trace back to China, which goes back to the attribution question. We can tell you what machine the information originates from, but not necessarily what is behind. We can tell you where that machine sits generally, but not necessarily who's running it or if it's a proxy for someone else. But I would say that without question, on a daily basis, I look at extensive electronic mapping efforts that appear with extremely high degree of confidence to come from China.
Alan?
There are 25 countries that have sophisticated cyber warfare capabilities, including the United States. Mm-hmm. China is just the noisiest, so we see them. But Russia has some of the most sophisticated capabilities, as do other countries, France and a bunch of others. So this isn't – China's just noisy about it. They actually have a strategy that's noisy. They don't care if they get seen. So the other countries do.
That's very fair.
When you say noisy, you don't mean noisy in the sense that we normally think of noisy.
Well, kind of. I mean, the China strategy sort of is, if I could be so bold, they sort of have a privateer's mentality. They seem to have a very large number of very highly trained people with sophisticated tools who seem to work in small freelance groups. And to think of it as the individual hacker now is not really correct. You can't understand as one individual all of the code in a sort of magic way that appears on movies. Generally, people work in teams. There's a guy who's a specialist in getting through Juniper networks, another guy who knows how to get through a Cisco PIC system. These are particular pieces of hardware with very sophisticated code, and you'll have an expert on your hacking team, and that's his job. And as they work their way through the system, you can see the teams of people trade off. And China just extremely aggressive and very sophisticated. And frankly, they don't care if they get spotted.
There are also, I gather, rumors that a significant number of personal computers have been infected with so-called malicious software. Tell us about malicious software, Alan, what that means and where it comes from.
Let me first tell you how it gets there,
okay.
Just so you know.
All right.
Oh, that's what that was.
Yeah.
You get an email that says, I just saw a great video, or an instant message, I just saw a great video. It looks like it came from a friend of yours, and you click on it to see the video. It says, do you want to download this video viewing program? You say, sure. And when you download that video viewing program, it may or may not do the video, but it also puts some junk on it. So it's with an email, with an instant message. You go to a website, click on it. That's how you get the malware. Now, what the malware does...
Malware.
Malicious software. Sorry.
It's okay.
Jargon.
It's okay. I'm learning.
I wish you didn't have to. But what it does is it takes over your computer and then makes money for people. And the main way it makes money for people is it lets your computer send out spam. You know, you don't get ads for Viagra, but some people get ads for Viagra and for your accounts being closed at so-and-so bank. That's all spam. You would think that no smart person would respond, but you got to admit, they wouldn't keep sending it out if people didn't respond. So it makes them a lot of money. That's a huge amount of money. So the second thing they do with your computer is they use it to flood other computers. All the online gambling sites have had this happen to them. They get flooded out so they can take no gambling bets. And then they get a message saying, hey, did you notice you couldn't take any bets for that hour on Saturday? You have to pay us $1 million if you want that to stop. So that's extortion. And then they also get used to put keystroke loggers on your system
What?
They read every keystroke, record it,
right,
and they send it off to a computer somewhere else and analyze it quickly, and then they take the ones that are your bank account name and password and empty that bank account. So those are the three principal economic engines of using personal computers.
And what about botnet? Explain what that is and how it works, Stephen.
Well, to Alan's completely correct in the way he outlined it, but people should not think of it as taking over their computer. It sort of borrows space in the background. Your computer continues to do what you're asking it to do, but you may go, my, it's hot, and it's humming and blinking a lot more than usual. It's because it's doing other things that are not visible to you. A botnet is a robotic network, and a botnet generally has a bot master, the robot master. And this is a person who sits at a computer, and generally spammers or denial of service people call him and say, I'd like to knock out this gambling site. How many computers can you give me tonight? He looks at what's up on the network. All the people have their computers plugged in at home, and he may have control software on 25,000, 60,000. We've even tracked them over 100,000 botnets under control at one time, and he sends them all a command to begin bombarding one site with packets of requested information, which will shut down the servers. Or he can use it to say, okay, I've got 20,000 botnets. I'll do some spam for you tonight. He sends them all the spam he wants sent, and they go out. So robotic networks are botnets.
Think of botnets as an army of infantrymen that are all directed after one target. And they not only can be used in order to shut down an online gambling site, but they can also be used to shut down banks. And in fact, that's what happened in the case of Estonia.
Yes, exactly.
And joining us now is Congressman Jim Langevin. He represents the 2nd District of Rhode Island. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane.
Congressman Langevin, cybersecurity has, according to our guests this morning, not been a national security, but you say it really should be. Tell us why you believe that so strongly.
Well, cybersecurity is an important national security issue, but it has not been given the attention that it deserves or needs, certainly at the level of the federal government. I think probably in many ways the private sector, particularly the banking system, is probably far ahead of the federal government in terms of securing its network, and we clearly recognize that even the private sector isn't as secure as it needs to be. So, you know, the federal government is even far beyond that. In my work as chairman of the subcommittee on emerging threats, cybersecurity, and science and technology, I've made it a priority for my subcommittee, and we're trying to raise it on the national agenda.
So what do you think it's going to take to get it onto the national agenda?
Well, the administration is clearly beginning to get its arms around the cybersecurity problem and has woken up to the fact that our computer networks are compromised. There's been numerous cybersecurity penetrations as well as exfiltration of data. It's been, again, long overdue that they've gotten the wake-up call, but the administration has put forth the cybersecurity initiative that's in the process of being reviewed and ultimately implemented right now. I think we're certainly moving in the right direction, but clearly more work needs to be done, and a lot of money is going to have to be spent to get us there. But it is my job, I see, as chairman of the subcommittee as well as sitting on the House Intelligence Committee, to make sure that this is a priority and that we're moving forward as aggressively as possible.
Do you think anything will be done this year? Do you think it's going to move forward?
Oh, it will. It is right now. The cybersecurity initiative is going through the authorization and the appropriations process right now, and we're going to do all we can to make sure that it's done the right way. I mean, the kind of jury is still out on whether the cybersecurity initiative is exactly what we need, but I think the administration is moving in the right direction. But clearly, we need more oversight here and more attention to it. My work on the subcommittee, we focused on two primary areas, and if you look at it, you kind of want to divide it into three categories. Federal network security, critical infrastructure security, and then security on the private sector. Our work is focused primarily right now in securing federal networks as well as critical infrastructure. And I'm most concerned personally about securing critical infrastructure because I think that's where the greatest damage could be done were there to be a cyber attack. For example, on the electric grid is where we've focused particular attention.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What about the question of water supply, Congressman?
Well, sure. That's all a part of critical infrastructure, that more work needs to be done there. It's another area that's been, personally, I think, has been ignored. And I think that's one of the shortcomings of the cybersecurity initiative, that it doesn't focus enough on critical infrastructure. And I've questioned the administration on that and have been pressing them to focus more on this. Now, I've been meeting with the entities responsible for protecting critical infrastructure. We've held hearings on my subcommittee, having both NERC and FERC before my subcommittee, and they're responsible for primarily looking at securing the electric grid, and they're moving ahead with more robust cybersecurity, and we will continue to press them on that. Water supply, the same thing.
One last question for you. Both Congressman Frank Wolf of Virginia and Chris Smith of New Jersey both reported that their computers had been broken into. What about yours, Congressman Langevin? Have you had anything happen with your computers to lead you to suspect they had been broken into?
To our knowledge, our computers here in my personal office have not been hacked. But of course, the problem with a lot of these cyber attacks is that you may not know that your system has been hacked. These rootkits attack, for example, they come in, they look like somebody else, and they change to look like the owner of the computer, so to speak, and can start exfiltrating data and probing around in there. So although we haven't had any problems here, we're not 100% certain. We can never be 100% certain. We're doing, the House is taking aggressive measures to make sure that the House networks are secure. But a lot of this requires, for example, that you do the basics. You have your firewalls in place. You have intrusion detection devices put in place. And again, you're exercising responsible, action on the computer, not going to sites that could, for example, compromise your computer. And if you're warned that you're going to a site where there could be a cyber penetration, you don't go to that site.
But does anyone have any senses yet as to who it was that broke into those two computers?
Well, again, it's attribution is very hard. I heard your guests talk about that earlier. And although we're not 100% certain about the attacks that you mentioned in terms of Congressman Wolf and Congressman Chris Smith, we suspect to, we know who did it. A lot of these attacks are coming out of China, for example, but attribution is difficult because you don't know whether it's coordinated or direct attack by the Chinese government or whether it's just a computer coming that originates, resides in China. So, again, attribution is a challenging issue.
Congressman Jim Langevin, he represents the 2nd District of Rhode Island. Thanks so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you, Diane.
And when we come back, we'll open the phones, take your calls, 800-433-8850. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org, and by the Wallace Foundation, whose Knowledge Center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The June Reader's Review, Eudora Welty's memoir about growing up in the South, how listening well helped her write better, and why a sheltered life can be a daring one as well. Eudora Welty's One Writer's Beginnings. This month's Reader's Review, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And it's time to open the phones. Let's go to Collinsville, Illinois. Good morning, Christopher. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you. In listening to the conversation, I've come up with several comments, but my original one was about the idea of security itself. The congressman recently said, it was important for private users to have things like the antivirus and spyware and things on their computers in place, and I think that's kind of a misnomer. I've been working with computers for 15 years, and people come to me and say, hey, my computer's running slow. Can you take a look at it? And the first question I always ask them is, what kind of security software do you have? And they tell me what they have, and then my next question is, when was the last time you ran it? And they say, generally, what do you mean? People don't realize that just having the security software in place is not good enough. These programs need to be run on a regular basis to really provide any type of security.
Paul,
your caller is right in many ways, but let me highlight one particular issue. Are we asking individual consumers to, if you will, do too much, asking too much of them to regularly update and regularly keep track of their security software. Is there, in fact, something that should be done to do a better job with security, if you will, up in the cloud, up in the web? An interesting story. Back in the 99, 2000, 2001 timeframe, we were talking, and this is when I was at the White House, talking to ISPs about what could they do.
ISPs?
Internet service providers.
Okay.
Like AOL, those type of providers.
Right.
What could they do to help? Could they, in fact, run filters that might filter out some of this bad code? And we got pushback. They didn't want to hear that. But that has changed. Now you have all the major telecommunications providers and the ISPs starting to do more to secure individual computers. I think what we're going to see happening is a migration into a lot more security happening within the cloud, and hopefully less of a burden on the individual consumer. However, they can still do something silly. They can click on something and provide their personal information when, in fact, they shouldn't.
Paul, Stephen, your point earlier during the break was that we're in a state of unknowing, and you likened it to back in 1916 when a 12-year-old could walk onto a sales lot and buy a car,
drunk.
And that was it. Drunk.
Yeah. Fundamentally, there are no rules of the road. We don't have a driver's license for computers. We don't have rules of the road for their use. We don't say who can and cannot buy them. And you have, frankly, a very large public policy debate. We had that debate in the 20s when it came to road safety and car safety, and it goes on today. And people now today have accepted, well, you know, stop signs are a good thing and seatbelts are a good thing and airbags are a good thing. But those actually were debated.
Well, and what kinds of rules of the road do you believe need to be put into place right now, Alan?
I think Steve's right on. It's the car analogy is perfect. I don't want every car owner to have to go out and find the right airbag and get a drill and drill into his car to install the airbag. I want it to come with the car. And what we have not done for the last 15 years is ask the people who sell us the computers to build security in, to bake it in. And one of the most exciting things that's happening is this idea of the federal government using its procurement power to ask the vendors to deliver safer systems so that the rest of us can buy it.
All right, let's go to West Union, Ohio. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Diane and panel. My computer career began in 1966 as a consultant. I retired in 95, and I got so fed up with personal computer security issues that I gave up my computer, and I don't do anything online other than use email at the library. But my question is, with all the power we have in computer systems, why isn't it more of a standard that all really critical information is stored internally in an encrypted format, including tables and parameters that drive the logic of systems, so that the hackers have a much more difficult time making sense with whatever information they get to?
Stephen.
Well, this is, as the congressman pointed out and as you're pointing out, this is one of the places, frankly, the commercial sector is rather much further ahead than most of the government and critical infrastructure sector. I can speak directly to the global credit card infrastructure and the global SwiftNet infrastructure, and we have extremely robust standards for encryption of data, storage of encryption at rest, and frankly, the largest problem that we face is what's called the data destruction or non-repudiation problem. Once I've used my credit card once, on average, 36 computers have to make a decision in under a second about that charge. The bank that issued you the card, the machine that's acquiring it, the bank that's acquiring it, the fraud detection systems, all 36 or more computers make a decision, and if gets the green light, it goes, how do we destroy that data so it doesn't repudiate and is subsequently stolen is a huge issue. But the cryptography standards, transmission standards are very, very robust in that part of the industry. There's other sections of the global infrastructure, and especially in government nets, where they have a couple of years of catching up to do.
And now to Dallas, Texas. Hi there, Kirk. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I'm a chief information officer at a very large medical center in Dallas. My operating budget is $40 million, every day I have to decide how I'm going to spend some of this money. And the question, this leads to my question, a comment and a question. I deal with a lot of consultants, security consultants, and I believe that many of them, they purvey this air of hysteria because it's in their really self interest to do so. This is how they make money. I don't deny that the incidents that your panel talks about happens every day, but there is a collection of these consultants that prey on this fear, hoping that they will make a lot of money. My question is, I don't know. I have not seen any information about how much money, a percentage of my operating budget is reasonable to spend on security. I see a lot of studies with bad methodology, but for those of us who are on the ground who manage this stuff every day, it is very unclear how much we should be spending, understanding that we cannot fully get rid, we cannot have a 100% secure system. And any cost that I spend on this kind of stuff, I have to pass along to patients in the form of higher health care. So that's my question. I'll listen to the answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, Kirk Allen.
I agree with him. I think that, and I know we sound like these hyperbolic people, and we're just describing incidents. There are two kinds of people in the world, the ones who have lived through it and the ones who haven't. The newest attack target are hospitals because they're such a great target for extortion. Because you take the patient data and then you threaten to expose all the patient's medical records if the hospital doesn't pay. The hospitals that hasn't happened to, security doesn't look like a problem. The hospitals it has happened
but
to.
But what specifically to his question, what percentage of his budget should be assigned?
The answer is less than he's spending now, not more than he's spending now. What has happened is we've spent all this money writing reports about security, buying stuff that doesn't work. What we need to do is build security into the products we buy, use our acquisition of other tools to buy security baked in, lowering the amount that each company has to pay.
Here's a caller from Ann Arbor, Michigan, basically on the same question. Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. My comment is simply, and I haven't heard this yet on the show, is that a huge amount of this problem is a Windows problem. That being, Windows is a fundamentally insecure operating system that was not written well, that has more than 1 million pieces of malware. My point is that I don't use Windows for myself, nor do I use it for the infrastructure of where I am at Michigan State University. I use something called OpenBSD. It is functional and it is secure. There are no viruses for it. There are no Trojans for it. I've even managed to put this operating system on machines for non-technical friends. There are alternatives to Windows, and it is time that people start thinking that Windows is a lost cause.
The caller is you know, it's the obvious point that we have to talk about is where does Microsoft fit in this whole problem? And if we go back in time to 2001, right after the attacks of 9/11, there was a series of attacks associated with a NIMDA virus that caused significant difficulty for the financial sector. The financial sector essentially went to Bill Gates and said, "You got to fix this. If you don't fix this, we're going to go elsewhere. We're going to chase down other sources, other providers." Microsoft has invested now more than anyone else to improve the security of their software. It is not invulnerable. In fact, the new systems continue to have problems.
Is
However,
any system invulnerable?
No. Dan, you're exactly right. To think that if we solve the Microsoft problem, we're okay is a huge mistake because the bad guys are going after all forms
Everything.
Of software. They're going after the routers. They're going after the switches. They're going after other operating systems. It's just that Microsoft continues to be in the news on this.
But what about what Steve says he's done to...
I feel the pain. Well, I was introduced as a security consultant. I mostly build solutions, very big networks. And I understand the question of investment ratio and also the concerns about Microsoft. Microsoft's 80% of the software that's in the installed base for end users. So the largest largest set of problems are going to sit in the largest installed base. But that doesn't make it unique. And the one caller mentioned FreeBSD, which is a beautiful, very light Unix kerneled operating system, but it can be attacked. Software is software. And I often don't even, with my clients, I try and get them mentally to stop even talking about information security because there's frankly no such thing. You can have risk assessment and you can have strong data custody or weak data custody. And if you think to yourself, well, what is the strongest way I can secure my system? That involves keeping everything in the known controls, with known softwares, with known protocols, and frankly, understanding what the risks and costs are if you do make a mistake or are penetrated.
All right. The question becomes, and a number of people have asked this, you know, which is more secure, a Mac or a PC? And then comes the question, if everything is as deeply flawed as we seem to be saying, is anything done, being done to create a better, more secure system? Alan. Sorry.
The real issue here, I think, is on the part of leadership in government. Since the National Strategy to Secure Cyberspace was issued in 2003, government has failed to lead until of late. It hasn't been a focus for senior executives inside our government. It hasn't been a focus on Capitol Hill. It hasn't been a focus by the private sector. So now we have this, if you will, this awakening going on where I think we're going to find more investment in a secure infrastructure. That's precisely what needs to happen before we start regulating.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to ask you all about some reports we had earlier this year that people who plugged into digital frames picked up computer problems as a result. Was that just a rumor, Alan, or what was going on?
No, that's one of the things that the Internet Storm Center picked up, our early warning system. It turns out that in the supply, you know the word supply chain, it means where the equipment you buy gets manufactured.
Right.
Somewhere in that process, in this case in China again, the software that was put on the digital picture frames had viruses in it.
And people got those for Christmas and use them all the time, and the thing just infected the computer.
Yes.
Immediately.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you all are talking a lot about China. We're going to have the Olympics in China. Mm-hmm. There are also stories that if you take your computer, your cell phone, whatever, with you, that somehow up there, your computer, your cell phone signal is going to be picked up and used. Paul.
First point, anyone who steps out of the United States with their cell phone, their PDA, their laptop, it's a different set of rules, a different set of laws that govern access to the airwaves than we have here in the United States. So that's statement one. Statement two is when you should you go to China, you must assume, A, that every communication that you have is going to be listened to because they have the authority to do that. They have the authority to record.
Those are their rules.
Yeah. Three, you can also assume in many cases that they might seek to install some sort of malware of some sort of capability within your system. So, if you will, it phones home and they might continue to listen to what you're doing.
Now, are you trying to scare us or have there been examples?
I can speak to examples. In several of my global clients in the banking and credit card spaces, you are not allowed to take electronics to China anymore. We only take printed binders.
I see.
And when we do have to take electronics for a variety of communications, we actually configure what's called a travel top, which is a laptop specifically configured only with the software necessary for you to set up a secure VPN, potentially to have either a secure chat or very specific documentation back to your
computers. Suppose somebody does take one of these things
to China. It will be penetrated
China.
And it will
okay,
be copied.
It's penetrated. What can you do when you come back home? Paul.
When you come back home, you can have your system administrator or your local IT tech take it apart and understand if there's anything inside
of it. Take the whole thing apart?
Well, just scrub it, if you will. But let me use this as a point. I want to make an important point
very
here.
Quickly.
There is no place in U.S. government where business where citizens can go to understand what the threat, the cyber threat is overseas. Right now, there's a big discussion going on. Do we talk to Americans about what might actually happen to them in China? There's no place you can go today to understand that.
And yes, we should.
We should have that.
Well, they've just heard it. Paul Kurtz, Stephen Spoonamore, Alan Paller, all cyber security consultants. You travel abroad with your computer at your own risk. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.